since 1937, about the same as you would get in many small towns. This was correct, but a wee disingenuous. The AT had no murders in its first 36 years, and 9 in the past 22. Still, her larger point was inarguable. You are more likely to be murdered in your bed in America than on the AT. Or, as an American friend put it to me much later, look, if you draw a 2,000-mile-long line across the United States at any angle, it's going to pass through 9 murder victims.
If you're interested, there's a book about one of the murders, she said, and reached below the counter.
She rooted for a moment in a box and brought out a paperback called 8 Bullets, which she passed to me for examination. It was about 2 hikers who were shot in Pennsylvania in 1988.
We don't keep it out because, you know, it's kind of upsetting, especially now, she said apologetically.
I bought it. And as she handed me my change, I mentioned to her the thought that if the women in Shenandoah had survived, they would be passing through about now.
Yeah, she said. I'd thought about that.
It was drizzling when I stepped back outside. I went up to Schoolhouse Ridge to have a look at the battlefield. It was a large park-like hilltop, with a wandering path lined at intervals with information boards describing charges and last-ditch stands and other confused, noisy action. The battle for Harper's Ferry was the finest moment for Stonewall Jackson, he who had last come to town to hang John Brown, because it was here, through some deft maneuvering and a bit of luck, that he managed to capture 12,500 Union troops, more American soldiers than would be captured in a single action until Bataan and Corregidor in World War II. Now Stonewall Jackson is a man worth taking an interest in. Few people in history have achieved greater fame in a shorter period, with less useful activity in the brain box than General Thomas J. Jackson. His idiosyncrasies were legendary. He was hopelessly, but inventively, hypochondriacal. One of his more engaging physiological beliefs was that one arm was bigger than the other, and in consequence he always walked and rode with that arm raised, so that his blood would drain into his body. He was a champion sleeper. More than once he fell asleep at the dinner table with food in his mouth. At the Battle of White Oak Swamp, his lieutenants found it all but impossible to rouse him and lift him, insensible, onto his horse, where he continued to slumber while shells exploded around him. He took obsessive zeal in recording captured goods and would defend them at all costs. His list of materiel liberated from the Union Army during the 1862 Shenandoah campaign included 6 handkerchiefs, 2¾ dozen neckties, and 1 bottle of red ink. He drove his superiors and fellow officers to fury, partly by repeatedly disobeying instructions, and partly by his paranoid habit of refusing to divulge his strategies, such as they were, to anyone. One officer under his command was ordered to withdraw from the town of Gordonsville, where he was on the brink of a signal victory, and march on the double to Staunton. Arriving in Staunton, he found fresh orders to go at once to Mount Crawford. There, he was told to return to Gordonsville. It was largely because of his habit of marching troops all over the Shenandoah Valley in an illogical and inexplicable fashion that Jackson earned a reputation among bewildered enemy officers for williness. His ineradicable fame rests almost entirely on the fact that he had a couple of small but inspiring victories when elsewhere Southern troops were being slaughtered and routed, and by dint of having the best nickname any soldier has ever enjoyed. He was unquestionably brave, but in fact it is altogether possible that he was given that nickname not for gallantry and daring, but for standing inert, like a stone wall, when a charge was called for. General Barnard B., who gave him the name at the First Battle of Manassas, was killed before the day was out, so the matter will remain forever unresolvable. His victory at Harper's Ferry, the greatest triumph for the Confederacy in the Civil War, was almost entirely because, for once, he followed the instructions of Robert E. Lee. It sealed his fame. A few months later, he was accidentally shot by his own troops at the Battle of Chancellorsville and died 8 days later. The war was barely half over. He was just 39. Jackson spent much of the war in and around the Blue Ridge Mountains, camping in and marching through the very woods and high gaps,
through which Katz and I had lately passed, so I was interested to see the scene of his greatest triumph, though really I was curious to learn if the developer had done anything up there worth getting indignant about. In the rain and dying light, I couldn't see any sign of new houses, certainly not on or near the sacred ground. So I followed the path around the undulating field, reading the information boards with dutiful attention, trying to be absorbed by the fact that Captain Pogue's battery had stood just here and Colonel Grisby's troops were arrayed over there, but being considerably less successful than one might hope when one is growing slowly soaked in the process. I didn't have the necessary energy to imagine the noise and smoke and carnage. Besides, I had had enough death for one day. So I tramped back to the car and pushed on. Chapter 14. In the morning I drove to Pennsylvania, 30 miles or so to the north. The Appalachian Trail runs for 230 miles in a northeasterly arc across the state, like the broad end of a slice of pie. I never met a hiker with a good word to say about the trail in Pennsylvania. It is, as someone told a National Geographic reporter in 1987, the place where boots go to die. During the last ice age, it experienced what geologists call a periglacial climate, a zone at the edge of an ice sheet characterized by frequent freeze-thaw cycles that fractured the rock. The result is mile upon mile of jagged, oddly angled slabs of stone strewn about in wobbly piles known to science as Falsenmeer, literally Sea of Rocks. These require constant attentiveness if you are not to twist an ankle or sprawl on your face. Not a pleasant experience with 50 pounds of momentum on your back. Lots of people leave Pennsylvania limping and bruised. The state also has what are reputed to be the meanest rattlesnakes anywhere along the trail, and the most unreliable water sources, particularly in high summer. The really beautiful Appalachian ranges in Pennsylvania, Nittany and Jacks and Tussie, stand to the north and west. For various practical and historical reasons, the AT goes nowhere near them. It traverses no notable eminences at all in Pennsylvania, offers no particularly memorable vistas, visits no national parks or forests, and overlooks the state's considerable history. In consequence, the AT is essentially just the central part of a very long, taxing haul connecting the South and New England. It is little wonder that most people dislike it. Oh, and it also has the very worst maps ever produced for hikers anywhere. The 6 sheets, maps is really much too strong a word for them, produced for Pennsylvania by a body called the Keystone Trails Association, are small, monochrome, appallingly printed, inadequately keyed, and astoundingly vague. In short, useless. Comically useless. Heartbreakingly useless, dangerously useless. No one should be sent into a wilderness with maps this bad. I had this brought home to me with a certain weep-inducing force as I stood in a parking lot in a place called Caledonia State Park, looking at a section of map that was simply a blurred smear of whorls, like a poorly taken thumbprint. A single contour line was interrupted by a printed number in microscopic type. The number said either 1800 or 1200. It wasn't possible to tell. But it didn't actually matter because there was no scale indicated anywhere, nothing to denote the height interval from one contour line to the next, or whether the packed bands of lines indicated a steep climb or precipitous descent. Not one single thing, not one single thing within the entire park and for some miles around was inscribed. From where I stood, I could be 50 feet or 2 miles from the Appalachian Trail in any direction. There was simply no telling. Foolishly, I had not looked at these maps before setting off from home. I had packed in a hurry, simply noted that I had the correct set, and stuck them in my pack. I looked through them all now with a sense of dismay, as you might a series of compromising pictures of a loved one. I had known all along that I was never going to walk across Pennsylvania. I had neither the time nor the spirit for it just now. But I had thought I might find some nice circular walks that would give me something of a challenging flavor of the state without making me endlessly retrace my steps. It was clear now, looking through the complete set, that not only were there no circular hikes to be had, but it was going to be the next thing to pure luck any time I stumbled on the trail at all. Sighing, I put the maps away and set off through the park on foot, looking for the familiar white blazes of the AT. It was a pleasant park in a wooded valley, quite empty on this fine morning. I walked for perhaps an hour along a network of winding paths, through trees and over wooden footbridges, but I failed to find the AT, so I returned to the car and pushed on, along a lonely highway through the dense flying leaves of Michaux State Forest, and on to Pine Grove Furnace State Park, a large recreation area built around a 19th-century stone kiln, now a picturesque ruin from which it takes its name. The park had snack huts, picnic tables, and a lake with a swimming area, but all were shut, and there wasn't a soul about. On the edge of the picnic area was a big dumpster with a sturdy metal lid that had been severely, arrestingly, mangled and dented and half-wrenched from its hinges, presumably by a bear trying to get at park garbage. I examined it with the deepest respect. I hadn't realized black bears were quite that strong. Here, at least, the AT blazes were prominent. They led around the lake and up through steep woods to the summit of Piney Mountain, which wasn't indicated on the map and isn't really a mountain since it barely rises to 1,500 feet. Still, it was challenging enough on a hot summer's day. Just outside the park, there is a board marking the traditional, but entirely notional, midpoint of the Appalachian Trail, with 1,080.2 indicated miles of hiking in either direction. Since no one can say exactly how long the AT is, the real midpoint could be anywhere within 50 miles or so. In any case, it would change from year to year because of reroutings. Two-thirds of thru-hikers never see it anyway, because they have dropped out by this point. It must actually be quite a depressing moment to have slogged through a mountainous wilderness for 10 or 11 weeks and to realize that for all that effort you are still but halfway there. It was also around here that one of the trail's more notorious murders took place, the one at the heart of the book, Eight Bullets, which I had bought at ATC headquarters the day before. The story is simply told. In May 1988, two young hikers, Rebecca White and Claudia Brenner, who also happened to be lesbians, excited the attention of a disturbed young man with a rifle, who shot them 8 times from a distance as they made love in a leafy clearing beside the trail. White was killed. Brenner, seriously wounded, managed to stumble down the mountain to a road and was rescued by some passing teenagers in a pickup truck. The murderer was swiftly caught and convicted. The next year, a young man and woman were killed by a drifter at a shelter just a few miles to the north, which rather gave Pennsylvania a bad reputation for a while. But then there were no murders anywhere along the AT for 7 years, until the recent deaths of the two young women in Shenandoah National Park. Their deaths brought the official murder toll to 9. Quite a large number for any footpath, no matter how you look at it. Though, in fact, there probably have been more. Between 1946 and 1950, 3 people vanished while hiking through one small area of Vermont, but they aren't included in the tally, whether because it happened so long ago or because it was never conclusively proved that they were murdered, I couldn't say. I was also told by an acquaintance in New England of an older couple who were killed by a deranged axe murderer in Maine sometime in the 1970s, but again it doesn't appear in any records because, evidently, they were on a side trail when they were attacked. Overnight I had read 8 Bullets, Brenner's account of the murder of her friend, so I was generally acquitted with the circumstances, but I intentionally left the book in the car, as it seemed a little morbid to go looking for a death site nearly a decade after the event. I wasn't remotely spooked by the murder, but even so I felt a vague, low-grade unease at being alone in a silent woods, so far from home. I missed Katz. Missed his puffing and bitching and unflappable fearlessness. Hated the thought that I could sit waiting on a rock till the end of time and he would never come. The woods were in full chlorophyll-choked glory now, which made them seem even more pressing and secretive. Often I couldn't see 5 feet into the dense foliage on either side of the path. If I did happen on a bear, I would be quite helpless. No cats would come along after a minute to smack it on the snout for me and say,
Jesus, Bryson, you caused me a lot of trouble. No one at all would come to share the excitement, it appeared. There didn't seem to be another person within 50 miles. I pushed on, filled with mild disquiet, feeling like someone swimming too far from shore. It was 3.5 miles to the top of Piney Mountain. At the summit I stood uncertainly, unable to decide whether to go on a little farther or turn back and perhaps try somewhere else. I couldn't help feeling a kind of helpless and dispiriting pointlessness in what I was doing. I had known for some time that I was not going to complete the AT, but only now was it dawning on me how foolish and futile it was to dabble in it in this way. It hardly mattered whether I went on 2 miles, or 5 miles, or 12 miles. If I walked 12 miles instead of, say, 5, what would it gain me after all? Certainly not any sight or experience or sensation that I hadn't had 1,000 times already. That was the trouble with the AT. It was all one immensely long place, and there was more of it, infinitely more of it, than I could ever conquer. It wasn't that I wanted to quit, quite the contrary. I was happy to walk, keen to walk. I just wanted to know what I was doing out here. As I stood in this state of indecision, there was a dry crack of wood, and a careless disturbance of undergrowth perhaps 50 feet into the woods, something good-sized and unseen. I stopped everything, moving, breathing, thinking, and stood on tiptoe, peering into the leafy void. The noise came again, nearer. Whatever it was coming my way. Whimpering quietly but sincerely, I ran 100 yards, day-pack bouncing, glasses jiggling, then turned, heart stopped, and looked back. A deer, a large buck, handsome and proud, stepped onto the path, gazed at me for a moment without concern, and sauntered on. I took a long moment to catch my breath, wiped a river of sweat from my brow, and felt profoundly discouraged. Everyone has a supremely low moment somewhere along the AT, usually when the urge to quit the trail becomes almost overpowering. The irony of my moment was that I wanted to get back on the trail and didn't know how. I hadn't lost just Katz, my boon companion, but my whole sense of connectedness to the trail. I had lost my momentum, my feeling of purpose. In the most literal way, I needed to find my feet again. And now, on top of everything else, I was quaking as if I had never been out in the woods before. All the experience I had piled up in the earlier weeks seemed to make it harder rather than easier to be out on the trail on my own. I hadn't expected this. It didn't seem fair. It certainly wasn't right. In a glum frame of mind, I returned to the car. I spent the night near Harrisburg, and in the morning drove north and east across the state on back highways, trying to follow the trail as closely as I could by road, stopping from time to time where possible to sample the trail, but without finding anything remotely rewarding, so mostly I drove. Little by little, the town names along the way began to take on a frank industrial tone: Port Carbon, Minersville, Slatedale, and I realized I was entering the strange, half-forgotten world of Pennsylvania's anthracite region. At Minersville, I turned onto a back highway and headed through a landscape of overgrown mine tailings and rusting machinery toward Centralia, the strangest, saddest town I believe I have ever seen. Eastern Pennsylvania sits on one of the richest coal beds on Earth. Almost from the moment Europeans arrived, they realized there was coal out there in quantities almost beyond conception. The trouble was, it was virtually all anthracite, a coal so immensely hard, it is 95% carbon, that for a very long time no one could figure out how to get it to light. It wasn't until 1828 that an enterprising Scot named James Neilson had the simple but effective idea of injecting heated air rather than cold air into an iron furnace by means of a bellows. The process became known as a hot blast, and it transformed the coal industry all over the world. Wales, too, had a lot of anthracite, but especially in the United States. By the end of the century, America was producing 300 million tons of coal a year, about as much as the rest of the world put together, and the great bulk of it came from Pennsylvania's anthracite belt. Meanwhile, to its intense gratification, Pennsylvania had also discovered oil. Not only discovered it, but devised ways to make it industrially useful. Petroleum, or rock oil, had been a curiosity of western Pennsylvania for years. It emerged in seeps along riverbanks, where it was blotted up with blankets to be made into patent medicines, esteemed for their value to cure everything from scrofula to diarrhea. In 1859, a mysterious figure named Colonel Edwin Drake, who wasn't a colonel at all, but a retired railway conductor with no understanding of geology, developed, from goodness knows where, the belief that oil could be extracted from the ground via wells. At Titusville, he bored a hole to a depth of 69 feet and got the world's first gusher. Quickly, it was realized that petroleum in volume could not only be used to bind bowels and banish scabby growths, but could be refined into lucrative products like paraffin and kerosene. Western Pennsylvania boomed inordinately. In 3 months, as John McPhee notes in Suspect Terrain, the endearingly named Pithole City went from a population of zero to 15,000, and other towns throughout the region sprang up. Oil City, Petroleum Center, Red Hot. John Wilkes Booth came and lost his savings, then went off to kill a president. But others stayed and made a fortune. For one lively half-century, Pennsylvania had a virtual monopoly on one of the most valuable products in the world, oil, and an overwhelmingly dominant role in the production of a second, coal. Because of the proximity of rich supplies of fuel, the state became the center of big, fuel-intensive industries like steelmaking and chemicals. Lots of people became colossally rich, but not the mine workers. Mining has, of course, always been a wretched line of work everywhere, but nowhere more so than in the United States in the second half of the 19th century. Thanks to immigration, miners were infinitely expendable. When the Welsh got belligerent, you brought in Irish. When they failed to satisfy you, you brought in Italians or Poles or Hungarians. Workers were paid by the ton, which both encouraged them to hack out coal with reckless haste, and meant that any labor they expended making their environment safer and more comfortable went uncompensated. Mine shafts were bored through the earth like holes through Swiss cheese, often destabilizing whole valleys. In 1846, at Carbondale, almost 50 acres of mine shafts collapsed simultaneously without warning, claiming hundreds of lives. Explosions and flash fires were common. Between 1870 and the outbreak of the First World War, 50,000 people died in American mines. The great irony of anthracite is that, tough as it is to light, once you get it lit, it's nearly impossible to put out. Stories of uncontrolled mine fires are legion in eastern Pennsylvania. One fire at Lehigh started in 1850 and didn't burn itself out until the Great Depression, 80 years after it started. And thus we come to Centralia. For a century, Centralia was a sturdy little pit community. However difficult life may have been for the early miners, by the second half of the 20th century, Centralia was a reasonably prosperous, snug, hard-working town with a population approaching 2,000. It had a thriving business district, with banks and a post office, and the normal range of shops and small department stores, a high school, four churches, an Oddfellows Club, a town hall. In short, a typical, pleasant, contentedly anonymous small American town. Unfortunately, it also sat on 24 million tons of anthracite. In 1962, a fire in a dump on the edge of town ignited a coal seam. The fire department poured thousands of gallons of water on the fire, but each time they seemed to have it extinguished, it came back, like those trick birthday candles that go out for a moment and then spontaneously reignite. And then, very slowly, the fire began to eat its way along the subterranean seams. Smoke began to rise eerily from the ground over a wide area, like steam off a lake at dawn. On Highway 61, the pavement grew warm to the touch, then began to crack and settle, rendering the road unusable. The smoking zone passed under the highway and fanned out through a neighboring woodland and up towards St. Ignatius Catholic Church on a knoll above the town. The U.S. Bureau of Mines brought in experts who proposed any number of possible remedies, digging a deep trench through the town, deflecting the course of the fire with explosives, flushing the whole thing out hydraulically. but the cheapest proposal would have cost at least $20 million, with no guarantee that it would work, and in any case, no one was empowered to spend that kind of money. So the fire slowly burned on. In 1979, the owner of a gas station near the center of town found that the temperature in his underground tanks was registering 172 degrees Fahrenheit. Sensors sunk into the earth showed that the temperature 13 feet under the tanks was almost 1,000 degrees. Elsewhere, people were discovering that their cellar walls and floors were hot to the touch. By now, smoke was seeping from the ground all over town, and people were beginning to grow nauseated and faint from the increased levels of carbon dioxide in their homes. In 1981, a 12-year-old boy was playing in his grandmother's backyard when a plume of smoke appeared in front of him. As he stared at it, the ground suddenly opened around him. He clung to tree roots until someone heard his calls and hauled him out. The hole was found to be 80 feet deep. Within days, similar cave-ins were appearing all over town. It was about then that people started getting serious about the fire. The federal government came up with $42 million to evacuate the town. As people moved out, their houses were bulldozed and the rubble was neatly, fastidiously cleared away until there were almost no buildings remaining. So today, Centralia isn't really even a ghost town. It's just a big open space with a grid of empty streets, still surreally furnished with stop signs and fire hydrants. Every 30 feet or so, there is a neat paved driveway going 15 or 20 yards to nowhere. There are still a few houses scattered around, all of them modest, narrow wood-frame structures, stabilized with brick buttresses, and a couple of buildings in what was once the Central Business District. I parked outside a building with a faded sign that said, rather grandly, Centralia Mine Fire Project, Office of the Columbia Redevelopment Authority. The building was boarded and all but falling down. Next door was another, in better shape, called Speed Stop Car Parts, overlooking a neatly groomed park with an American flag on a pole. The shop appeared to be still in business, but the interior was darkened and there was no one around. There was no one anywhere, come to that, no passing traffic, not a sound but the lazy clank of a metal ring knocking against the flagpole. Here and there in the vacant lots were metal cylinders, like oil drums, that had been fixed in the ground and were silently venting smoke. Up a slight slope, across an expanse of vacant lots, a modern church, quite large, stood in a lazy pall of white smoke. St. Ignatius, I assumed. I walked up. The church looked sound and usable. The windows were not boarded, and there were no keep-out signs, but it was locked, and there was no board announcing services or anything even to indicate its name or denomination. All around it, smoke was hovering wispily off the ground, and just beneath it, great volumes of smoke were billowing from the earth over a large area. I walked over and found myself on the lip of a vast cauldron, perhaps an acre in extent, which was emitting thick, cloud-like, pure white smoke, the kind of smoke you get from burning tires or old blankets. It was impossible to tell through the stew of smoke how deep the hole was. The ground felt warm and was loosely covered in a fine ash. I walked back to the front of the church. A heavy metal crash barrier stood across the old road, and a new highway curved off down a hillside away from the town. I stepped around the barrier and walked down old Highway 61. Clumps of weedy grass poked through the surface here and there, but it still looked like a serviceable road. All around, on both sides, for a considerable distance, the land smoked broodingly, like the aftermath of a forest fire. About 50 yards along, a jagged crack appeared down the center of the highway and quickly grew into a severe gash several inches across, emitting still more smoke. In places, the road on one side of the gash had subsided a foot or more, or slumped into a shallow, bowl-shaped depression. From time to time I peered into the crack, but couldn't gauge anything of its depth for the swirling smoke, which proved to be disagreeably acrid and sulfurous when the breeze pushed it over me. I walked along for some minutes, gravely examining the scar, as if I were some kind of official inspector of highways, before I spread my gaze more generally, and it dawned on me that I was in the middle, very much in the middle, of an extensively smoking landscape, on possibly no more than a skin of asphalt above a fire that had been burning out of control for 34 years. Not, I'm bound to say, the smartest place in North America to position oneself. Perhaps it was no more than a literally heated imagination, but the ground suddenly seemed distinctly spongy and resilient, as if I were walking across a mattress. I retreated in haste to the car. It seemed odd, on reflection, that I, or any other severely foolish person, could drive in and have a look around a place as patently dangerous and unstable as Centralia, and yet there was nothing to stop anyone from venturing anywhere. What was odder still was that the evacuation of Centralia was not total. Those who wanted to stay and live with the possibility of having their houses fall into the earth were allowed to remain, and a few had evidently so chosen. I got back in the car and drove up to a lone house in the center of town. The house, painted a pale green, was eerily neat and well-maintained. A vase of artificial flowers and other modest decorative knick-knacks stood on a windowsill, and there was a bed of marigolds by the freshly painted stoop. But there was no car in the drive, and no one answered the bell. Several of the other houses proved on closer inspection to be unoccupied. Two were boarded and had "Danger, keep out" notices tacked to them. Five or six others, including a clutch of three on the far side of the Central Park, were still evidently lived in. One, amazingly, even had children's toys in the yard. Who on earth would keep children in a place like this? But there was no answer at any of the bells I tried. Everyone was either at work or, for all I knew, lying dead on the kitchen floor. At one house I knocked at, I thought I saw a curtain move, but I couldn't be sure. Who knows how crazy these people might be after 3 decades of living on top of an inferno and breathing head-lightening quantities of CO2, or how weary they might have grown of outsiders cheerfully poking around and treating their town as a curious diversion. I was privately relieved that no one answered my knocks, because I couldn't for the life of me think what my opening question would be. It was well past lunchtime, so I drove the 5 miles or so to Mount Carmel, the nearest town. Mount Carmel was mildly startling after Centralia. A busy little town, nicely old-fashioned, with traffic on Main Street and sidewalks full of shoppers and other townsfolk going about their business. I had lunch at the Academy Luncheonette and Sporting Goods Store, possibly the only place in America where you can gaze at jockstraps while eating a tuna salad sandwich, and was intending then to push on in search of the AT, but on the way back to the car I passed a public library and impulsively popped in to ask if they had any information on Centralia. They did. 3 fat files bulging with newspaper and magazine clippings, most dating from 1979 to 1981, when Centralia briefly attracted national attention, particularly after the little boy, one Todd Dombowski, was nearly swallowed by the earth in his granny's backyard. There was also, poignantly now, a slender, hard-bound history of Centralia, prepared to mark the town's centenary just before the outbreak of the fire. It was full of photographs showing a bustling town, not at all unlike the one that stood just outside the library door, but with the difference of 30-some years. I had forgotten just how distant the 1960s had grown. All the men in the photographs wore hats, the women and girls were in billowy skirts. All, of course, were happily unaware that their pleasant, anonymous town was quite doomed. It was nearly impossible to connect the busy place in the photographs to the empty space from which I had just come. As I put the things back in their folders, a clipping fluttered to the floor. It was an article from Newsweek. Someone had underlined a short paragraph towards the end of the article and put 3 exclamation marks in the margin. It was a quote from a mine fire authority, observing that if the rate of burning held steady, there was enough coal under Centralia to burn for 1,000 years. It happened that a few miles beyond Centralia, there was another scene of arresting devastation that I had heard about and was keen to investigate. A mountainside in the Lehigh Valley that had been so lavishly polluted by a zinc mill that it had been entirely stripped of vegetation. I had heard about it from John Connolly, who recalled it as being near Palmerton. So I drove there the following morning. Palmerton was a good-sized town, grimy and industrial, but not without its finer points. A couple of solid turn-of-the-century civic buildings that gave it an air of consequence, a dignified central square, and a business district that was clearly depressed, but gamely clinging to life. The background was dominated everywhere by big prison-like factories, all of which appeared to be shut. At one end of town, I spotted what I had come to find, a steep, broad eminence, perhaps 1,500 feet high and several miles long, which was almost entirely naked of vegetation. There was a parking lot beside the road and a factory 100 yards or so beyond. I pulled into the lot and got out to gawk. It truly was a sight. As I stood there, some fat guy in a uniform stepped out of a security booth and waddled towards me, looking cross and officious.
"The hell you think you're doing?" he barked.
"Pardon me?" I replied, taken aback, and then, "I'm looking at that hill."
"You can't do that."
"I can't look at a hill?"
"Not here, you can't. This is private property."
"I'm sorry, I didn't know."
"Well, it's private, like the sign says."
He indicated a post that was in fact signless and looked momentarily struck.
"Well, it's private," he added.
"I'm sorry, I didn't know," I said again, not appreciating yet how keenly this man took his responsibilities. I was still marveling at the hill. "That's an amazing sight, isn't it?" I said.
"What is?"
"That mountain. There isn't a scrap of vegetation on it."
"I wouldn't know. I'm not paid to look at hillsides."
"Well, you should look sometime. I think you'd be surprised."
"So is that the zinc factory, then?"
I said with a nod at the complex of buildings over his left shoulder. He regarded me suspiciously.
"What do you want to know that for?"
I returned his stare. "I'm out of zinc," I replied. He gave me a sideways look as if to say, "Oh, a wise guy, huh?" and said suddenly, decisively,
"I think maybe I'd better take your name."
With difficulty, he extracted a notebook and a stubby pencil from a back pocket.
"What? Because I asked you if that was a zinc factory?" "Because you're trespassing on private property."
"I didn't know I was trespassing. You don't even have a sign up." He had his pencil poised.
"Name?"
"Don't be ridiculous."
"Sir, you are trespassing on private property. Now, are you going to tell me your name?"
"No." We went through a little back and forth along these lines for a minute. At last he shook his head regretfully and said,
"Play it your way, then."
He dragged out some communication device, pulled up an antenna, and got it to operate. Too late, I realized that for all his air of exasperation, this was a moment he had dreamed of during many long, uneventful shifts in his little glass booth.
"J.D.,"
he said into the receiver.
"Luther here. You got the clamps? I got an infractor in Lot A."
"What are you doing?" I asked.
"I'm impounding your vehicle."
"Don't be ridiculous. I only pulled off the road for a minute. Look, I'm going, okay?" I got in the car, started the engine, and made to go forward, but he blocked the way. I leaned from the window.
"Excuse me!"
I called, but he didn't move. He just stood with his back to me and his arms crossed, conspicuously disregarding me. I tooted the horn lightly, but he was not to be shifted. I put my head out the window and said,
"All right, I'll tell you my name, then."
"It's too late for that."
"Oh, for God's sake," I muttered, and then, out the window,
"please," and then, whinily,
"come on, buddy, please."
But he had set a course and was not to be deflected. I leaned out once more.
"Tell me, did they specify asshole on the job description, or did you take a course?"
Then I breathed a very bad word and sat and steamed. 30 seconds later, a car pulled up and a man in sunglasses got out. He was wearing the same kind of uniform as the first guy, but was 10 or 15 years older, and a whole lot trimmer. He had the bearing of a drill sergeant.
"Problem here?"
he said, looking from one to the other of us.
"Perhaps you can help me," I said in a tone of sweet reason. "I'm looking for the Appalachian Trail. This gentleman here tells me I'm trespassing."
"He was looking at the hill, J.D.,"
the fat guy protested a little hotly, but J.D. raised a palm to still him, then turned to me.
"You a hiker?"
"Yes, sir," I indicated the pack on the back seat. "I just wanted directions, and the next thing I know," I gave a cheerfully dismayed laugh,
"this man's telling me I'm on private property and he's impounding my car."
"J.D., the man was looking at the hill and asking questions."
But J.D. held up another calming hand.
"Where are you hiking?"
I told him.
He nodded.
Well, then, you want to go up the road about 4 miles to Little Gap and take the right for Danielsville. At the top of the hill, you'll see the trail crossing. You can't miss it.
Thank you very much.
Not a problem. You have a good hike, you hear?
I thanked him again and drove off. In the rearview mirror, I noticed with gratification that he was remonstrating quietly but firmly with Luther, threatening, I very much hoped, to take away his communication device. The route went steeply up to a lonesome pass where there was a dirt parking lot. I parked, found the AT, and walked along it on a high exposed ridge through the most amazingly devastated terrain. For miles it was either entirely barren or covered in the spindly trunks of dead trees, a few still weakly standing but most toppled. It brought to mind a World War I battlefield after heavy shelling. The ground was covered in a gritty black dust, like iron filings. The walking was uncommonly easy. The ridge was almost perfectly flat, and the absence of vegetation provided uninterrupted views. All the other visible hills, including those facing me across the narrow valley, looked to be in good health, except where they had been scarred and gouged by quarrying or strip mining, which was regularly. I walked for a little over an hour until I came to a sudden, absurdly steep descent to Lehigh Gap, almost 1,000 feet straight down. I wasn't at all ready to stop walking. In fact, I was just getting into my stride, but the idea of going down 1,000 feet only to turn around and come straight back up held zero appeal, and there wasn't any way to double back without walking miles along a busy highway. That was, of course, the trouble with trying to do the AT in day-sized pieces. It was designed for pushing on, ever on, not for dipping in and out of. With a sigh, I turned around and trudged back the way I had come, in a mood neatly suited to the desolate landscape. It was almost 4 o'clock when I reached the car, much too late to try an alternative hike elsewhere. The afternoon was as good as shot. I had driven 350 miles to get to Pennsylvania, had spent 4 long days in the state, and walked a net 11 miles of the Appalachian Trail. Never again, I vowed, would I try to hike the Appalachian Trail with a car. Chapter 15. Once, eons ago, the Appalachians were of a scale and majesty to rival the Himalayas, piercing, snow-peaked, pushing breathtakingly through the clouds to heights of 4 miles or more. New Hampshire's Mount Washington is still an imposing presence, but the stony mass that rises from the New England woods today represents, at most, the stubby bottom, 1/3 of what was 10 million years ago. That the Appalachian Mountains present so much more modest an aspect today is because they have had so much time in which to wear away. The Appalachians are immensely old, older than the oceans and continents, at least in their present configurations, far, far older than most other mountain chains, older indeed than almost all other landscape features on Earth. When simple plants colonized the land and the first creatures crawled gasping from the sea, the Appalachians were there to greet them. Something over 1 billion years ago, the continents of Earth were a single mass called Pangaea, surrounded by the lonely Panthalasian Sea. Then, some unexplained turmoil within the Earth's mantle caused the land to break apart and drift off as vast asymmetrical chunks. From time to time over the ages since, 3 times at least, the continents have held a kind of grand reunion, floating back to some central spot and bumping together with slow but crushing force. It was during the 3rd of these collisions, starting about 470 million years ago, that the Appalachians were first pushed up, like a rucked carpet, as the analogy nearly always has it. 470 million years is a span pretty well beyond grasping, but if you can imagine flying backwards through time at the rate of 1 year per second, it would take you about 16 years to cover such a period. It's a long time. The continents didn't just move in and out from each other in some kind of grand slow-motion square dance, but spun in lazy circles, changed their orientation, went on cruises to the tropics and poles, made friends with smaller land masses and brought them home. Florida once belonged to Africa. A corner of Staten Island is, geologically, part of Europe. The seaboard from New England up to Canada appears to have originated in Morocco.
Parts of Greenland, Ireland, Scotland, and Scandinavia have the same rocks as the eastern United States, are in effect ruptured outposts of the Appalachians. There are even suggestions that mountains as far south as the Shackleton Range in Antarctica may be fragments of the Appalachian family. The Appalachians were formed in three long phases, or orogenies, as geologists like to call them, known as the Taconic, Acadian, and Alleghenian. The first two were essentially responsible for the northern Appalachians, the third for the central and southern Appalachians. As the continents bumped and nudged, sometimes one continental plate would slide over another, pushing ocean floor before it, reworking the landscape for 150 miles or more inland. At other times, it would plunge beneath, stirring up the mantle and resulting in long spells of volcanic activity and earthquakes. Sometimes the collisions would interleave layers of rock like shuffled playing cards. It is tempting to think of this as some kind of giant continent-sized car crash, but of course it happened with imperceptible slowness. The Proto-Atlantic Ocean, sometimes more romantically called Iapetus, which filled the void between continents during one of the early splits, looks in most textbook illustrations like a transitory puddle. There, in Figure 9A, vanished in Figure 9B, as if the sun had come out for a day or so and dried it up. Yet it existed far longer, hundreds of millions of years longer, than our own Atlantic has. So it was with the formation of mountains. If you were to travel back to one of the mountain-building phases of the Appalachians, you wouldn't be aware of anything geologically grand going on, any more than we are sensible now that India is plowing into Asia like a runaway truck into a snowbank, pushing the Himalayas up by a millimeter or so a year. And as soon as the mountains were built, they began, just as ineluctably, to wear away. For all their seeming permanence, mountains are exceedingly transitory features. In Meditations at 10,000 Feet, writer and geologist James Treffel calculates that a typical mountain stream will carry away about 1,000 cubic feet of mountain in a year, mostly in the form of sand granules and other suspended particles. That is equivalent to the capacity of an average-sized dump truck, clearly not much at all. Imagine a dump truck arriving once each year at the base of a mountain, filling up with a single load, and driving off, not to reappear for another 12 months. At such a rate, it seems impossible that it could ever cart away a mountain, but in fact, given sufficient time, that is precisely what would happen. Assuming a mountain 5,000 feet high, with 500,000 million cubic feet of mass, roughly the size of Mount Washington, a single stream would level it in about 500 million years. Of course, most mountains have several streams and, moreover, are exposed to a vast range of other reductive factors, from the infinitesimal acidic secretions of lichen, tiny but relentless, to the grinding scrape of ice sheets. So most mountains vanish very much more quickly, in a couple of 100 million years, say. Right now, the Appalachians are shrinking on average by 0.03 millimeters per year. They have gone through this cycle at least twice, possibly more, rising to awesome heights, eroding away to nothingness, rising again, each time recycling their component materials in a dazzlingly confused and complex geology. The detail of all of this is theory, you understand. Very little of it is more than generally agreed upon. Some scientists believe the Appalachians experienced a fourth, earlier mountain-building episode called the Grenville Orogeny, and that there may have been others earlier still. Likewise, Pangaea may have split and reformed not three times, but a dozen times, or perhaps a score of times. On top of all of this, there are the number of lapses in the theory, chief of which is that there is little direct evidence of continental collisions, which is odd, even inexplicable, if you accept that at least three continents rubbed together with enormous force for a period of at least 150 million years. There ought to be a suture, a layer of scar tissue, stretching up the eastern seaboard of the United States. There isn't. I am no geologist. Show me an unusual piece of graywack or a handsome chunk of gabbro, and I will regard it with respect and listen politely to what you have to say, but it won't actually mean anything to me. If you tell me that once it was seafloor ooze, and that through some incredible sustained process it was thrust deep into the earth, baked,
and squeezed for millions of years, then popped back to the surface, which is what accounts for its magnificent striations, its shiny vitreous crystals, its flaky biotite mica, I will say, "Goodness!" and, "Is that a fact?" But I can't pretend that anything actual will be going on behind my game expression. Just occasionally am I permitted an appreciative glimpse into the wonder that is geology, and such a place is the Delaware Water Gap. There, above the serene Delaware River, stands Kittatinny Mountain, a wall of rock 1,300 feet high, consisting of resistant quartzite, or so it says here, that was exposed when the river cut a passage through softer rock on its quiet, steady progress to the sea. The result, in effect, is a cross-section of mountain, which is not a view you get every day, or indeed anywhere else along the Appalachian Trail that I am aware of. And here it is particularly impressive, because the exposed quartzite is arrayed in long, wavery bands that lie at such an improbably canted angle, about 45 degrees, as to suggest to even the dullest imagination that something very big, geologically speaking, happened here. It is a very fine view. A century or so ago, people compared it to the Rhine, and even, a little ambitiously I'm bound to say, the Alps. The artist George Innes came and made a famous painting called Delaware Water Gap. It shows the river rolling lazily between meadowy fields dotted with trees and farms, against a distant backdrop of sere hills, notched with a V where the river passes through. It looks like a piece of Yorkshire or Cumbria transplanted to the American continent. In the 1850s, a plush 250-room hotel called Kittatinny House rose on the banks of the river and was such a success that others soon followed. For a generation after the Civil War, the Delaware Water Gap was the place to be in summer. Then, as is always the way with these things, the White Mountains came into fashion, then Niagara Falls, then the Catskills, then the Disneys. Now almost no one comes to Water Gap to stay. People still pass through in large numbers, but they park in a turnout, have a brief appreciative gaze, then get back in their cars and drive off. Today, alas, you have to squint, and pretty hard at that, to get any notion of the tranquil beauty that attracted Innes. The Water Gap is not only the nearest thing to spectacle in eastern Pennsylvania, but also the only usable breach in the Appalachians in the area of the Poconos. In consequence, its narrow shelf of land is packed with state and local roads, a railway line, and an interstate highway with a long, unimaginative concrete bridge carrying streams of humming trucks and cars between Pennsylvania and New Jersey. The whole suggesting, as McPhee neatly put it in Suspect Terrain, a convergence of tubes leading to a patient in intensive care. Still, Kittatinny Mountain, towering above the river on the New Jersey side, is a compelling sight, and you can't look at it, at least I couldn't, at least not this day, without wanting to walk up it and see what is there. I parked at an information center at its base and set off into the welcoming green woods. It was a gorgeous morning, dewy and cool, but with a kind of sunshine and sluggish air that promises a lot of heat later on, and I was early enough that I could get almost a full day's walk in. I had to get the car home to New Hampshire by the following day, but I was determined to get at least one decent walk in, to salvage something from the catastrophe that was this trip, and luckily I seemed to have chosen well. I was in the midst of several thousand acres of exquisitely pretty woodlands, shared jointly by Worthington State Forest and the Delaware Water Gap National Recreation Area. The path was well maintained and just steep enough to feel like healthful exercise rather than some kind of obsessive torture. And here was a final, joyous bonus. I had excellent maps. I was now in the cartographically thoughtful hands of the New York, New Jersey Trail Conference, whose maps are richly printed in four colors, with green for woodland, blue for water, red for trails, and black for lettering. They are clearly and generously labeled, and sensibly scaled, 1 to 36,000. And they include in full all connecting roads and side trails. It is as if they want you to know where you are, and to take pleasure in knowing it. I can't tell you what a satisfaction it is to be able to say, "Ah! Dunfield Creek, I see. And, so that must be Shawnee Island down there. If all the AT maps were anything as good as this, I would have enjoyed the experience appreciably more, say 25% more. It occurred to me now that a great part of my mindless indifference to my surroundings earlier on was simply that I didn't know where I was, couldn't know where I was. Now at last I could take my bearings, perceive my future, feel as if I was somehow in touch with a changing and noble landscape. And so I walked 5 thoroughly agreeable miles up Kittatinny to Sunfish Pond, a very comely 41-acre pond surrounded by woods. Along the way, I encountered just 2 other people, both day hikers, and I thought again what a stretch it is to suggest that the Appalachian Trail is too crowded. Something like 30 million people live within 2 hours' drive of the water gap. New York was just 70 miles to the east, Philadelphia a little bit more to the south, and it was a flawless summer's day. Yet the whole of this majestic woods belonged to just 3 of us. For northbound hikers, Sunfish Pond is something of a glorious novelty, since nowhere south of here will you find a body of water on a mountaintop. It is, in fact, the first glacial feature northbound hikers come across. During the last ice age, this was about as far as the ice sheets got. The farthest advance in New Jersey was about 10 miles south of the water gap, though even here, where the climate would let it go no farther, it was still at least 2,000 feet thick. Imagine it. A wall of ice nearly 0.5 mile high, and beyond it, for tens of thousands of square miles, nothing but more ice, broken only by the peaks of a very few of the loftiest mountains. What a sight that must have been. And here is a thing that most of us fail to appreciate. We are still in an ice age, only now we experience it for just part of the year. Snow and ice and cold are not really typical features of Earth. Taking the long view, Antarctica is actually a jungle. It's just having a chilly spell. At the very peak of the last ice age, 20,000 years ago, 30% of the Earth was under ice. Today, 10% still is. There have been at least 12 ice ages in the last 2 million years, each lasting about 100,000 years. The most recent intrusion, called the Wisconsin Ice Sheet, spread down from the polar regions over much of Europe and North America, growing to depths of up to 2 miles and advancing at a rate of up to 400 feet a year. As it soaked up the Earth's free water, sea levels fell by 450 feet. Then, about 10,000 years ago, not abruptly exactly, but near enough, it began to melt back. No one knows why. What it left in its wake was a landscape utterly transformed. It dumped Long Island, Cape Cod, Nantucket, and most of Martha's Vineyard, where previously there had just been sea, and it gouged out the Great Lakes, Hudson Bay, and Little Sunfish Pond, among much else. Every foot of the landscape from here on north would be scored and scarred with reminders of glaciation. Scattered boulders called erratics, drumlins, eskers, high tarns, cirques. I was entering a new world. No one knows much of anything about the Earth's many ice ages, why they came, why they stopped, when they may return. One interesting theory, given our present-day concerns with global warming, is that the ice ages were caused not by falling temperatures, but by warming ones. Warm weather would increase precipitation, which would increase cloud cover, which would lead to less snow melt at higher elevations. You don't need a great deal of bad weather to get an ice age. As Gwen Schultz notes in Ice Age Lost, it is not necessarily the amount of snow that causes ice sheets, but the fact that snow, however little, lasts. In terms of precipitation, she observes, Antarctica is the driest large area on Earth, drier overall than any large desert. Here's another interesting thought. If glaciers started reforming, they have a great deal more water now to draw on. Hudson Bay, the Great Lakes, the hundreds of thousands of lakes of Canada, none of which existed to fuel the last ice sheet. So they would grow very much quicker. And if they did start to advance again, what exactly would we do? Blast them with TNT, or maybe nuclear warheads? Well, doubtless we would. But consider this. In 1964, the largest earthquake ever recorded in North America rocked Alaska with 200,000 megatons of concentrated might, the equivalent of 2,000 nuclear bombs. Almost 3,000 miles away in Texas, water sloshed out of swimming pools. A street in Anchorage fell 20 feet. The quake devastated 24,000 square miles of wilderness, much of it glaciated. And what effect did all this might have on Alaska's glaciers? None. Just beyond the